This podcast is a production of Bread on the Water Media and RadioForThePeople.com and is engineered by Audio Diner Studios. Our theme music is provided to us by our dear friend Gordon Bonham, whose music can be purchased through GordonBonham.com. Our graphics for this podcast are provided by Kathy Piercy Fryan. The podcast is sponsored by Artisan Realtors and Silicon Prairie Ventures.
This podcast is intended to give people a glimpse at what it's like to get a bad diagnosis, whether it's cancer or something else, and then go through a traumatic experience. First, we will discuss how my cancer story affected me and my family. Then we will talk about how their experiences affect other patients and their families, including discussions around why you need to advocate for yourself or for your family member. As we explore other patients' experiences, we will talk to some professionals about how to move forward after a traumatic or not medical event. I expect this to be a discussion that changes over time to reflect these combined experiences that I and others have had, and what our journeys are like, and the inevitable twists and turns that go along with real-world experiences. Join us on this ride as we attempt to show joy and laughter as well as the tragedy. Good afternoon. This is Normal. What's That Like? Episode 13. And I think we have that right this time. Last time we were confused, or I was confused about what episode this was. But our guest today is Dr. Rita Ossi, and we're going to be talking to her. But before we do that, we, as always, have to thank our sponsors. First of all, we want to thank Kat Fryan for her artwork that is on the website, and sometimes it's in the video, but today it won't be in the video. Sorry, Kat. And then we also want to thank Gordon Bonham, who provides our intro and exit music. And we also want to thank Silicon Prairie Ventures, which is, as I always have started doing lately, it's really Kevin Friedley, who's the producer and the technical side of all this stuff. So, and Kevin is here. He's not going to be on camera today, but you might hear his voice. Oh, there's his hand. Exciting stuff. So, without any further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Rita Ossi, hematology oncology at IU Cancer Center, and assistant professor at IU School of Medicine. At least that's what your business card says, right?
That's true. Part of it. Thank you for having me today. The pleasure is mine, of course. I mean, you know, you're doing a lot of efforts to help patients and caregivers, and that's admirable, especially after everything you've been through. So thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. You're going to find this out as we talk today, but no, the audience, not you, Dr. Ossi. The audience is going to find out that you are actually my oncologist. And so, but what I want you to first do is tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got here, what you do, kind of a thing, and education, anything in professional life, yep. Anything you feel is important to, yep. For people to know.
Sure. As you said, I'm a hematologist-oncologist, meaning that I specialize in the treatment of cancers, specifically blood cancers. And I mostly see patients who are diagnosed with leukemia and lymphoma. I also do cellular therapy, meaning stem cell transplant and CAR T-cell therapy. Another passion of mine is doing clinical research as well to help patients and science advance. I graduated in 2018 from MD Anderson Cancer Center. It was a long journey to get there. I'm an immigrant. I come from Lebanon, and I had intensive training at the American University of Beirut before that. And after I graduated, I decided to go back to my country, and then, you know, a lot of events happened, and that drove me back to come to the States. You know, priorities change with time, and having kids make you think 1,000 times before you make decisions. So I went back to the States in 2022, and then in 2023, I was recruited to Indiana University, and I've been here for 3 years. I've I've been fortunate since being here, you know, fortunate with the team that I work with and the patients that I have and the progress that I've been able to make throughout the last 3 years.
Awesome. As I stated earlier, Dr. Rossi is my oncologist. For those of you who followed my story at all, and if you haven't, go back and listen to episodes 1 and 2, because my story takes 2 whole episodes to tell. But if you followed my story, you'll know that I went through hospitalization for a really long time, 60 some days, and got out on the other side and was beginning to heal. And that's when I wanted a second opinion and got changed doctors. And my introduction to Dr. Rossi, the very first day we met, several things happened, but I won't bore you with all the details. But the bottom line is, after we talked, and she had reviewed my chart, knew lots of things about me before I ever got there, had reviewed my chart and looked at me at the very end of our conversation and said, well, I think I can help you, and I might even be able to cure you. And that was a refreshing thing for me, because that isn't anything I had heard previous to that. And so you also have a amazing ability to connect with people, which isn't always a thing that doctors are very good at.
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
So how do you manage the, I mean, when you're going to see a new patient like that, I mean, how do you make that connection, and how I mean, you're so positive, how do you maintain that?
You know, that takes me back to why I decided to do that, right? I mean, I've always been fascinated by science, specifically by how blood works, how the immune system works. I come from a family of doctors, so I was like already, you know, kind of steered towards that specialty. But then also along the way, because again, I witnessed that since I was very young, what matters throughout all of this is the relationships you build with people, the fight and the journey you actually go through with those people. This is not an easy specialty. It's very daunting, it's very demanding, it's very emotionally intense, and there's no way that you can disconnect the way you walk out the door. So you take it with you, you take those patients and their families with you. But you know, what keeps me positive is that, yes, this is going to be a hard fight most of the time, but at least I can try to translate that into a plan for you. And this is where my hope comes, because if I can give you a plan, whether the endpoint is going to be cure or improvement in quality of life, or giving you at least some good time or good quality of time, that matters a lot. And I know that I put myself in the shoes of every patient and a caregiver, and I wish that one day, if I need someone, I want someone to address me the same way.
That's awesome. Even delivering bad news, you remain very positive, and I would what I will echo is my own personal experience is when I had my second recurrence and had this big tumor in my abdomen. She did exactly what she just described. She said, okay, we've got this thing, but I have a plan. She actually had a couple of plans and said it was the family, because I think two of my kids even came to the appointment, and you know, for us to decide what we wanted to do. And so she's very inclusive, and I found all of that. It's all been I won't say it's all been a great journey, because it certainly hasn't, and certainly the immunotherapy piece that I did 2 summers ago literally is the hardest thing I've ever gone through in my life, most difficult thing, but here I am today, know, 14 months clear, 15 months actually clear, and so we're excited about that and excited about the future, and we go from there. But so what's your typical day? Tell us about your typical day.
I just want to say that you're a living example of why I do what I do. You know, like you and I went through a lot, right? You've been sick many times, and I tried to remain positive, and I tried to keep you positive as well. And you know, delivering bad news is the one of the hardest aspects of that job. It doesn't get better. There's no way we master it. I think what makes it go through is telling the truth in a sensitive way while also delivering a plan, especially when the physician still has options, and they are very good options. So this is, he is on a mission or she is on a mission to convince the patient and their family that, listen, I might still have a good option for you, so let's try it at least. What a typical day for me looks like depends whether you're asking me how I wake up or I'll be honest with you, I'm a workaholic, so I do sleep very, very little. I wake up every night anywhere between 2 and 4 a.m. I like this silent time a lot, not because there's no chaos or kids around. I just feel like I'm at my best, you know. I make my coffee, sit down, put a podcast, and sit down to work. I answer emails, I write notes, I work on my projects. Then 5:30, 6 in the morning, I start getting things ready for the kids. They wake up around 6:15. While they're having their breakfast, I take my shower. And always my son says, why you don't take breakfast? Like, why don't you have your breakfast like us? I don't have time for this. Then I drive to work, you know, after dropping them at school. I drive to work, and this is where my day starts, you know, seeing patients, whether in clinic or on the floor, and you know, managing administrative duties as well, replying to emails, doing procedures, coordinating with other parts of the team, like, you know, my nurse, my coordinator, the navigators, the pharmacist, the social worker, replying to patients' questions and emails and phone calls. So it's always like a very, very busy day. I personally do not stop to have lunch. So if I ever eat, I eat on the go. And my nurse Alexa always does a great job to remind me that I need to drink water. And the day, you know, does not end there, because whether it's 5 p.m., 6 p.m., calls can still flow. And then, you know, I go through the same routine. So that's my typical work day looks like. But I'm happy to answer any other questions.
So, yeah. but you do some teaching too, right?
I do. So there are days when we do have lectures, didactic lectures for learners, you know, from students to fellows to advanced care providers, nurses sometimes. I do national, international, regional lectures. I am the president of the Indiana Oncology Society, which is one of the societies under, you know, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, and it's pretty active in educating patients and caregivers. So I'm very involved in that as well. But I mean, for me, as an academic physician, every day, everything I do is a teaching process. I want to teach patients as well about their disease, and that matters a lot for me. But at the same time, I'm a student of my patients and their families.
And the research, when does that fit in?
The research is always present across the board. This is, I think, how I'm wired to be, thinking about what's next, what can I do next, what can we do next, you know, for patients. So that's always there. The research comes either through what we teach or what we are taught and what we attend. Research comes through what we can make available for patients as well.
And so do you learn about new trials and things through the same kind of thing, yeah, that you're doing for other people, right?
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, I always appreciate when patients come asking for clinical trials, or is there anything new going on for my disease? That's one of the best questions that I like to get, you know, in clinic. So that's also, like, if there's something that I'm not aware of, I go dig further. But at the same time, you know, it's constant education for me. I'm part of cooperative group trials that are national, you know, in the US and Canada. I'm also part of international groups. I sit on national panels for guidelines. So that's a constant and continuous education for me as well about what's new.
So is that in your 2 to 4 a.m. kind of?
That's exactly right. That's all the time.
How do you decide, I mean, and this is just, I think this is more from a patient side.
Yeah.
How do you decide with a specific patient what trial or drugs or protocol or...
Yeah. You know, treatment is personalized these days. It's personalized not only based on the disease itself and the genetics of this disease and the behavior of this disease. I also look and take a lot into account who the patient is and what they want. Who the patient is in terms of their age, their performance status, their medical problems, their logistics, where they live, what they can accommodate or afford to do as well. And of course, very importantly, what the patient wants to do. That's why I lay out options and I try to guide them to the best of my, you know, knowledge about what I think could be best for them. And this is how I decide on treatment. I try, you know that very well. Yeah. I try to always involve the patient and their caregiver in the decision-making process as well. And that's actually an asset for me. It does not contrariate what I want to do. It helps me a lot with what I want to do.
Well, just because I'm going to skip to a different question, how can patients help their doctor or an especially oncologist?
Yeah, you know, patients play the most important role in all of that. They're actually the pilot of their journey. We work for them. I'll tell the patient, listen, I work for you now. not only I'm going to work for you. The patient can help with very simple things, starting from asking questions about their disease. What is the disease? What that mean? Precautions at home. What do I do? What type of treatments do I have? All the questions related to the disease. Even questions related to social aspects of the disease. Questions related to financial aspects of the disease. I think this is the most important part because for me, I do my job better when I'm able to prevent issues from happening rather than addressing them when they happen. So that's point number one that is of utmost importance.
And so this again, I'm skipping ahead on my list that I prepared earlier. From time to time, I'm sure this comes up, because it's come up with me just as a patient, is this the thought that that some kind of holistic treatment
yes.
is going to, you know, I literally had friends tell me, well, just stop ingesting any sugar or yeah. you only drink water for yeah. 3 months. And so how do you, I mean, so first of all, I got to say, my wife is a medically trained, she's yeah. a advanced practice nurse. So I'm going to always lean towards the side of medicine,
yeah.
but not everybody feels that way.
Yeah.
And so when somebody comes in and they have a loved one, or even maybe that's what they're thinking,
yeah.
How do you deal with that?
This is a very common situation. And when patients ask those questions, I never feel irritated. I put myself in that situation, especially coming from a specific upbringing where, you know, good diet was very important
right.
for me. Like good diet, good environment, a healthy diet, you know, Mediterranean diet. I actually like those questions and I want them to be presented to me rather than patients going and thinking that they need to hide it from me because
right.
I will not be happy. I don't believe that holistic medicine and, you know, the regular practice that we do contrariate each other. I think they complement each other. I always believe in a very balanced diet. I never tell patients that follow just a specific diet. I definitely recommend a healthy diet with what is defined as healthy, like don't overdo any aspect of that diet. Regarding the point of sugar, yes, there is data that, you know, cutting sugar intake might be healthy, but not in the way some patients think. We do know that, you know, cancer cells can still create their own nutrients network even if you starve yourself for days. They can
right.
still eat. They create
that. I tried that, remember?
Inherently. Yes, you did try that. But also at the same time, we know that refined sugars are not good. Not good,
right.
not only
right.
for cancer patients.
For you in general,
right. Yes.
right.
For me, if someone comes to me with questions about supplements, if I know about the supplement, I make a recommendation whether like this has any interaction with our medications
right.
or not. I believe that supplements should be taken raw. Like if you take a plant and put it in a capsule, this is not natural.
Right.
It's not organic.
Right.
I get a lot of questions, for example, about dandelion roots.
Right.
I was raised eating dandelion roots for long years in my life, but I know very well how to eat it. It has to be, you know, taken out of the ground, washed, and eaten raw.
Right.
With a little bit of salt or whatever you like. You do not necessarily boil it. You do not put
right.
it in a capsule. So there are things that I don't know or I haven't
right.
heard of. This is where I tell the patient, let me look.
Yeah.
I will read about it. Or I sometimes involve our pharmacists in checking interactions if there's like any established information in the literature. I would never also force a patient to do things one way over the other. I always tell them that this is my best recommendation and this is based on the best information that I have. It's at the end of the day their choice of how they want to do things.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What once, if there was one single piece of advice you'd have for patients or their families?
That's something I learned myself as a patient, not as a cancer patient, but as a patient. Use all the support and the help you could get. This is not a one-person journey. It's too heavy, too burdensome, too emotionally intense to be carried by one person. Not only the patient, also the caregiver. Use us as physicians available for you, use our nurses, use our social worker, use our support system, whatever it is, just explore your options. And also for the caregiver, you know, you do have a big job of sustaining that patient throughout their journey. They rely on you. But for that, you also need to be okay. You need to take care of yourself, you need to sleep, you need to eat, and you also need to explore options. So ask us those questions. Is there any way I can get some help? And that, you know, help can come in different ways, whether financial, whether physical, or also sometimes emotional or well-being support. So we do have a lot of resources and we would like, you know, to come forward with them. Not
right.
necessarily when we're asked, but we would love to be asked for that.
Yeah, well, that's really important because I will say, and people who have listened to a podcast, I talk about a team.
Yeah.
And I would say that I looked at you as the captain of the team,
yeah.
But there were other team members
yeah.
that were
That's
very important
yeah.
in my
yeah.
In my journey, and
yeah.
from the infusion people to your nurse
yeah.
to the physical rehab piece to the psychological piece to the whole thing. I mean, it really is. It's
yeah,
a big thing.
It's a big thing. And care has become too complicated for one person to bear, right? You know, I would never pretend that I understand the financial part of it. I can tell you that I know that there's financial toxicity, but can I explain it to you? No. That's why I recommend that, you should talk to this person.
Right.
Or we will try to figure it out. Or I can support you with letters, but I need to understand exactly what's going on. Same for the social worker. Same for the nursing team. One person cannot do it all. It's impossible.
That's the whole point of this podcast, really.
Yeah.
I mean, there's two points to it. I mean, honestly, and I try to reiterate this one. One is, I originally, part of doing it was for men because men don't talk about this stuff.
Sure.
Women are a lot better at talking about
part.
This for the most part. Not
yeah.
not it's certainly not inclusive.
Yeah.
But and I've learned that some of my listeners that are the most avid listeners are women, and some of them are not cancer patients, but they're caregivers
yes.
of a cancer patient
yeah.
Because they want to hear just things from a different
yep.
level. But as we're talking about cancer and cancer is going and you know, I did a clinical trial and I've done
yep.
CAR T, but what else is that? I mean, what's the future?
Yeah.
Is there, what's coming down the pipeline?
I think the future is exciting. We have a glimpse of the future already, you know. 10 years ago, we did not have most of those treatments. When sometimes a patient failed the first line, in lymphoma, let's say, it's very hard, you know, to cure them later on. Now we do have a lot of treatment options. And sometimes even when the endpoint is not cure by itself, but, you know, survival is important,
right.
quality of life, symptom. It doesn't mean that the treatment has become just easier across the board. No, it's a process. It's very demanding. It's very daunting. And you've been through that. There are side effects. There are lots of appointments, right, and follow-ups. But at least we do have, you know, better outcomes, better supportive care, better results. And then, yes, definitely our patients are surviving more. What's happening more in the future is us relying on the immune system as we understand how it works more and better. More immunotherapy, earlier CAR T-cell therapy, not waiting for patients to relapse one or two times, maybe like just consolidating from the very beginning, trying to select upfront who is the patient who might relapse and whether we can follow on them in a better way, using, you know, circulating DNA to follow on lymphoma. This is all in the making, and this is all going to transpire very soon, and we will have results very soon for that.
That's exciting stuff. I love to hear it because, I mean, we never know if we're going to have relapse or however you want to describe that.
And, that's true.
And I love to know that there's something else, that there's a new, and I know there, I mean, there is now, but there's different immunotherapies that they're doing and a second kind of CAR T.
There are different types of CAR T, definitely. And I think, you know, just stemming from your own story, I think your viewers know that you were on a clinical trial. I think for me, you were convinced with the clinical trial because I was convinced with the clinical trial. I believed in that clinical trial, and I believe that I can, you know, do a better job with you on that clinical trial. That is a good combination, and now it's listed in the guidelines, actually. And you were in a very tough spot. So we needed something that is different from what you had before. That's a very important thing. If your physician does not believe in the clinical trial, you should not believe in the clinical trial.
That's a great great thought. Well, so what people that don't have cancer or don't have a family member that has cancer, what can they do? I mean, because we have people that listen to the podcast just because they care, but what can people do that are interested in helping? What kinds of things?
I think, as we said, you know, support comes in different way, right? Philanthropy, supporting even movements dedicated to further science and research, or supporting survivors, you know, like when we do the Light of the Night, for example. Such things. Philanthropy is definitely very important. I think what's way more important than all of this is trust in science, that not everyone is after you. We want to help you. You know, we are also human beings. We will get sick. We will be sick. We will need help. So we have families. We have emotions. We don't do things just for the sake of getting paid. We don't get paid for clinical trials, by the way. So we want to help. And I think for me, if people believe in us, a lot of our problems will not exist.
Amen.
Yeah.
What I guess my last thing is there anything that we haven't discussed that we should have discussed, or anything that you want to talk about that wasn't on my list kind of thing?
Two things maybe I didn't say. The first one is, you know, for patients and caregivers, yes, we talked about them asking questions, but beyond the questions, sharing concerns is very important. You know, what worries you? That's a very important thing to be shared. Be honest with your physician. Even if you feel like you want a second opinion, you are entitled to 1,000 opinions. That's okay. Don't feel that you are insulting anyone by saying that I want a second opinion. And trust me, if your doctor cares about you, they would not be insulted with you getting a second opinion. So that's point number one. Never shy away from your rights. These are your rights. Point number two is, for whoever is listening to you, if they are a patient or the caregiver or know a patient, just believe that there is hope. We are doing way better than years ago. So be open to hearing the suggestions or treatment plan. And if you feel like you saw a physician or you are in a system where you don't feel comfortable, try someone else. It's okay. Until you find your comfort and where you click and connect.
So something just came to me. So even though I said this, we're going to wrap up. Age.
Yeah.
Cancer patients, I mean, especially lymphoma, I'm sure you get lots of older patients. Yeah. And I know that sometimes, I even have a relative who went through this, and he felt like the treatment, and again, I don't know who he saw, I don't have any of that information, but he saw a doctor and basically didn't feel like the treatment was worth it. How would you respond to that?
You know, age is an important factor, but age by itself is not a sole determinant of how we move, right? The age is always coupled to the physiological age and the performance status prior to this disease, like how active you were. Were you like bedbound? Were you just, you go every day to get your groceries, or you walk every day? There's difference between all of this. And it's always coupled with medical problems and what sort of medical problems people have. But with the current treatments that we have, age is no longer a taboo or a limit to a lot of the treatment options, especially immunotherapy. Now, we do not have a limit on CAR T, for example, when it comes to age, especially that we have different agents in CAR T. Some of them are easier in terms of side effects compared to others, and we have a lot of data published on that. So we do not sanction anyone based on their age that, because you are 80, you cannot get CAR T. Other agents like bispecifics or targeted therapy can be used in this patient population. I'm someone who respects the biological age, because yes, if you do have an older patient, you do not want to bombard them with chemo, especially if you have a good alternative. Why do you want to go that route? So patients need to also know that it's not only chemo anymore. There's a lot of other options.
And I guess for the same thing, the younger, because I know you've had some young patients as well.
Yeah. Same for young patients. I mean, even if they're young, it doesn't mean that I can use that against them and bombard them with chemo.
Right.
Again, that takes us to the same point when we said how we choose treatment. We choose treatment based on several factors. One of them is age and performance status. But if a patient comes to you, even if they're 25, and tell you, you know what, there's no way on earth that I want to lose my hair, that's a no-no. Then I have to find an alternative, for example. So patients' wishes are always our commands as well.
I think that's a great place to stop. What do you think?
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for doing this, and we'll make sure that you know how to find it to if you want to share it with anybody. And again, I applaud you from a personal standpoint, because our relationship has been very effective, I guess is how I would describe it. And we've become sort of friends. I mean,
yes, we are.
With that, we'll conclude this. I again at the end have to thank our sponsors, Kat Frayn and Gordon Bonham, and also Silicon Prairie Ventures and Kevin Friedley. But with that, this is the end of episode 13 of Normal, What's That Like?
Thank you. Normal is overrated. Thank you.